number one fan has just listened to the second time of Skylark of Space. Thank you so very much.
Go tape.
Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
And it is Tuesday, the 13th of June, and for the first time in a little while here, I'm actually able to listen to Anon Radio live. So whatever network disturbances were occurring have apparently settled down. Anyhow, I'm going to continue this time with Memoirs of Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, the chapter on John Law and the Mississippi Bubble Scandal in France. And I'll probably also read the South Sea Bubble chapter, purely because the author presents it specifically as a contrast to the Mississippi Bubble chapter. I think the water I was heating for tea has boiled. Hold on a moment. All right. It's just Lipton's green in a tea bag. Tobe would not approve, but at least it's something. Now, where was I? Memoirs of Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. By Charles McKay. After discussing how the Parliament of Paris, which was a law court, attempted to quash John Law's bank and was overawed by the regent, the Duke of Orléans, who arrested the president and two of the councillors of the Parliament, forced them to comply. Thus the first cloud upon Law's prospects blew over. Freed from apprehension of personal danger, he devoted his attention to his famous Mississippi project, the shares of which were rapidly rising in spite of the Parliament. At the commencement of the year 1719, an edict was published granting to the Mississippi Company the exclusive privilege of trading to the East Indies, China, and the South Seas, and to all the possessions of the French East India Company established by Colbert. The company, in consequence of this great increase of their business, assumed as more appropriate the title of Company of the Indies, and created 50,000 new shares. The prospects now held out by Law were most magnificent. He promised a yearly dividend of 200 livres upon each share of 500, which, as the shares were paid for in billets d'état at their nominal value, but worth only 100 livres, was at the rate of about 120% profit. Or maybe 200%. Well, there's no way in the world for that not to be a dangerous transaction. The public enthusiasm, which had been so long rising, could not resist a vision so splendid. At least 300,000 applications were made for the 50,000 new shares, and Law's house in the Rue des Quincampoix was beset from morning to night by the eager applicants. As it was impossible to satisfy them all, it was several weeks before a list of the fortunate new stockholders could be made out, during which time the public impatience rose to a pitch of frenzy. Dukes, marquises, counts with their duchesses, marchionesses, and countesses waited in the streets for hours every day before Mr. Law's door to know the result. At last, to avoid the jostling of the plebeian crowd, which to the number of thousands filled the whole thoroughfare, they took apartments in the adjoining houses, that they might be continually near the temple whence the new Plutus was diffusing wealth. Every day the value of the old shares increased, and the fresh applications, induced by the golden dreams of the whole nation, became so numerous that it was deemed advisable to create no less than 300,000 new shares at 5,000 livres each, in order that the regent might take advantage of the popular enthusiasm to pay off the national debt. For this purpose, the sum of 1,500 millions of livres was necessary. Such was the eagerness of the nation that thrice the sum would have been subscribed if the government had authorized it. Law was now at the zenith of his prosperity, and the people were rapidly approaching the zenith of their infatuation. The highest and the lowest classes were alike filled with a vision of boundless wealth. There was not a person of note among the aristocracy, with the exception of the Duke of Saint-Simon and Marshal Villars, who was not engaged in buying or selling stock. People of every age and sex and condition in life speculated in the rise and fall of the Mississippi bonds. The Rue des Quincampoix was the grand resort of the jobbers, and it being a narrow, inconvenient street, accidents continually occurred in it from the tremendous pressure of the crowd. Houses in it, worth in ordinary times 1,000 livres of yearly rent, yielded as much as 12 or 16,000. A cobbler, who had a stall in it, gained about 200 livres a day by letting it out and furnishing writing materials to brokers and their clients. The story goes that a hump-backed man who stood in the street gained considerable sums by lending his hump as a writing desk to the eager speculators. The great concourse of persons who assembled to do business brought a still greater concourse of spectators. These again drew all the thieves and immoral characters of Paris to the spot, and constant riots and disturbances took place. At nightfall it was often found necessary to send a troop of soldiers to clear the street. The great inconvenience of Victorian works of this kind is that they very, very rarely cite the sources the author draws on. I'd love to know, is this contemporary newspaper accounts he's using? Law, finding the inconvenience of his residence, removed to the Place Vendôme, whither the crowd of agioteurs followed him. An agioteur, I believe, is a person who attempts to make a profit by a difference in prices. The agio is the conventional term for the difference between the exchange rate for foreign currency, which the bank buys it at from you, and the exchange rate at which they will sell it to you. That spacious square soon became as thronged as the Rue des Quincampoix. From morning to night it presented the appearance of a fair. Booths and tents were erected for the transaction of business and the sale of refreshment, and gamblers with their roulette tables stationed themselves in the very middle of the place, and reaped a golden, or rather a paper, harvest from the throng. The boulevards and public gardens were forsaken. Parties of pleasure took their walks in preference in the Place Vendôme, which became the fashionable lounge of the idle, as well as the general rendezvous of the busy. The noise was so great all day that the chancellor, whose court was situated in the square, complained to the regent and the municipality that he could not hear the advocates. Law, when applied to, expressed his willingness to aid in the removal of this nuisance, and for this purpose entered into a treaty with the Prince de Carignan for the Hôtel de Soissons, which had a garden of several acres at the rear. A bargain was conducted by which Law became the purchaser of the hotel at an enormous price, the prince reserving to himself the magnificent gardens as a new source of profit. They contained some fine statues and several fountains, and were altogether laid out with much taste. As soon as Law was installed in his new abode, an edict was published forbidding all persons to buy or sell stock anywhere but in the gardens of the Hôtel de Soissons. In the midst, among the trees, about 500 small tents and pavilions were erected for the convenience of the stock-jobbers. Their various colors, the gay ribands and banners which floated from them, the busy crowds which passed continually in and out, the incessant hum of voices, the noise, the music, and the strange mixture of business and pleasure on the countenances of the throng, all combined to give the place an air of enchantment that quite enraptured the Parisians. The Prince de Carignan made enormous profits while the delusion lasted. Each tent was let at the rate of 500 livres a month, and as there were at least 500 of them, his monthly revenue from this source alone must have amounted to 250,000 livres, or upwards of 10,000 pounds sterling. The honest old soldier, Marshal Villars, was so vexed to see the folly which had smitten his countrymen that he never could speak with temper on the subject. Passing one day through the Place Vendôme in his carriage, the choleric gentleman was so annoyed at the infatuation of the people that he abruptly ordered his coachman to stop, and putting his head out of the carriage window, harangued them for full half an hour on their disgusting avarice. This was not a very wise proceeding on his part. Hisses and shouts of laughter resounded from every side, and jokes without number were aimed at him, there being at last strong symptoms that something more tangible was flying through the air in the direction of his head. The marshal was glad to drive on. He never again repeated the experiment. Two sober, quiet, and philosophic men of letters, Monsieur de Lamotte and the Abbé Terrasson, congratulated each other that they at least were free from this strange infatuation. A few days afterwards, as the worthy abbé was coming out of the Hôtel de Soissons, whither he had gone to buy shares in the Mississippi, whom should he meet but his friend Lamotte entering for the same purpose? "Ha!" said the abbé, smiling. "Is that you?" "Yes," said Lamotte, pushing past him as fast as he was able. "And can that be you?" The next time the two scholars met, they talked of philosophy, of science, and of religion, but neither had courage for a long time to breathe one syllable about the Mississippi. At last, when it was mentioned, they agreed that a man ought never to swear against his doing any one thing, and that there was no sort of extravagance of which even a wise man was not capable.
Pardon me.
During this time, Law, the new Plutus, had become all at once the most important personage of the state. The antechambers of the regent were forsaken by the courtiers. Peers, judges, and bishops thronged to the Hôtel de Soissons. Officers of the army and navy, ladies of title and fashion, and everyone to whom hereditary rank or public employ gave a claim to precedence, were to be found waiting in his antechambers to beg for a portion of his India stock. Law was so pestered that he was unable to see one-tenth part of the applicants, and every maneuver that ingenuity could suggest was employed to gain access to him. Peers, whose dignity would have been outraged if the regent had made them wait half an hour for an interview, were content to wait 6 hours for the chance of seeing Monsieur Law. Enormous fees were paid to his servants if they would merely announce their names. Ladies of rank employed the blandishments of their smiles for the same object, but many of them came day after day for a fortnight before they could obtain an audience. When Law accepted an invitation, he was sometimes so surrounded by ladies, all asking to have their names put down in his lists as shareholders in the new stock, that, in spite of his well-known and habitual gallantry, he was obliged to tear himself away perforce. The most ludicrous stratagems were employed to have an opportunity of speaking to him. One lady, who had striven in vain during several days, gave up in despair all attempts to see him at his own house, but ordered her coachman to keep a strict watch whenever she was out in her carriage, and if he saw Mr. Law coming, to drive against a post and upset her. The coachman promised obedience, and for 3 days the lady was driven incessantly through the town, praying inwardly for the opportunity to be overturned. At last she espied Mr. Law, and pulling the string called out to the coachman, "Upset us now, for God's sake, upset us now!" The coachman drove against a post, the lady screamed, and Law, who had seen the accident, hastened to the spot to render assistance. The cunning dame was led into the Hôtel de Soissons, where she soon thought it advisable to recover from her fright, and after apologizing to Mr. Law, confessed her stratagem. Law smiled and entered the lady in his books as the purchaser of a quantity of India stock. Another story is told of a Madame de Bouchat, who, knowing that Mr. Law was at dinner at a certain house, proceeded thither in her carriage and gave the alarm of fire. The company started from the table, and Law among the rest, but, seeing one lady making all haste into the house toward him, while everybody else was scampering away, he suspected the trick and ran off in another direction. Many other anecdotes are related, which, even though they may be a little exaggerated, are nevertheless worth preserving as showing the spirit of that singular period. Footnote: the curious reader may find an anecdote of the eagerness of the French ladies to retain Law in their company, which will make him blush or smile, according as he happens to be very modest, or the reverse. It is related in the letters of Madame Charlotte Elizabeth de Bavière, Duchess of Orléans, Volume 2, page 274. Oh, my. The regent was one day mentioning, in the presence of D'Argenson, the Abbé Dubois, and some other persons, that he was desirous of deputing some lady, of the rank at least of a duchess, to attend upon his daughter at Modena. But, added he, I do not exactly know where to find one. No, replied one in affected surprise, I can tell you where to find every duchess in France. You have only to go into Mr. Law's. You will see them every one in his antechamber. Monsieur de Chirac, a celebrated physician, had bought stock at an unlucky period and was very anxious to sell out. Stock, however, continued to fall for 2 or 3 days, much to his alarm. His mind was filled with the subject when he was suddenly called upon to attend a lady who imagined herself unwell. He arrived, was shown upstairs, and felt the lady's pulse. It falls, good God, it falls continuously," said he, musing. It falls, good God, it falls continually," said he, musingly, while the lady looked up in his face, all anxiety for his opinion. "Oh, Monsieur de Chirac," said she, starting to her feet and ringing the bell for attendance, I am dying, it falls. "What falls?" inquired the doctor in amazement. My pulse," said the lady, "I must be dying." "Calm your apprehensions, my dear madame," said Monsieur de Chirac. "I was speaking of the stocks. The truth is I have been a great loser, and my mind is so disturbed I hardly know what I have been saying." The price of shares sometimes rose 10 or 20% in the course of a few hours, and many persons in the humbler walks of life, who had risen poor in the morning, went to bed in affluence. An extensive holder of stock, being taken ill, sent his servant to sell 250 shares, at 8,000 livres each, the price at which they were then quoted. The servant went, and on his arrival in the Jardin des Soissons, found that in the interval the price had risen to 10,000 livres. The difference of 2,000 livres on the 250 shares, amounting to 500,000 livres, or £20,000, he very coolly transferred to his own use, and giving the remainder to his master, set out the same evening for another country. Law's coachman, in a very short time, made money enough to set up a carriage of his own, and requested permission to leave his service. Law, who esteemed the man, begged of him as a favor that he would endeavor before he went to find a substitute as good as himself. The coachman consented, and in the evening brought two of his former comrades, telling Mr. Law to choose between them, and he would take the other. Cookmaids and footmen were now and then as lucky, and in the full-blown pride of their easily acquired wealth, made the most ridiculous mistakes. Preserving the language and the manners of their old, with the finery of their new station, they afforded continual subjects for the pity of the sensible, the contempt of the sober, and the laughter of everybody. But the folly and meanness of the higher ranks of society were still more disgusting. One instance alone, related by the Duc de Saint-Simon, will show the unworthy avarice which infected the whole of society. A man of the name of André, without character or education, had, by a series of well-timed speculations in Mississippi bonds, gained enormous wealth in an incredibly short space of time. As Saint-Simon expresses it, he had amassed mountains of gold. As he became rich, he grew ashamed of the lowness of his birth, and anxious, above all things, to be allied to nobility. He had a daughter, an infant only 3 years of age, and he opened a negotiation with the aristocratic and needy family of Doyze that this child should, upon certain conditions, marry a member of that house. The Marquis Doyze, to his shame, consented and promised to marry her himself on her attaining the age of 12, if the father would pay him down the sum of 100,000 crowns and 20,000 livres every year until the celebration of the marriage. The Marquis was himself in his 33rd year. This scandalous bargain was duly signed and sealed, the stockjobber furthermore agreeing to settle upon his daughter on the marriage day a fortune of several millions. Wait a moment for the dogs to calm down. I think the postman just went by. The Duke of Brancas, the head of the family, was present throughout the negotiation and shared in all the profits. Saint-Simon, who treats the matter with the levity becoming what he thought so good a joke, adds that people did not spare their animadversions on this beautiful marriage, and further informs us that the project fell to the ground some months afterward by the overthrow of Law and the ruin of the ambitious Monsieur André. It would appear, however, that the noble family never had the honesty to return the 100,000 crowns. Whether the écu d'argent or the écu d'or is meant here, I don't know, but in any case it was physical money, not shares, or paper, billet d'état. Amid events like these, which, humiliating though they be, partake largely of the ludicrous, others occurred of a more serious nature. Robberies in the streets were of daily consequence. Robberies in the streets were of daily occurrence in consequence of the immense sums in paper which people carried about with them. Assassinations were also frequent. One case in particular fixed the attention of the whole of France, not only on account of the enormity of the offense, but of the rank and high connections of the criminal. The Count de Horn, a younger brother of the Prince de Horn, and related to the noble families of D'Arenberg, de Ligne, and de Montmorency, was a young man of dissipated character, extravagant to a degree, and unprincipled as he was extravagant. In connection with two other men as reckless as himself, named Mille, a Piedmontese captain, and one D'Estamp or Lestang, a Fleming, he formed a design to rob a very rich broker, who was known, unfortunately for himself, to carry great sums about his person. The Count pretended a desire to purchase of him a number of shares in the Company of the Indies, and for that purpose appointed to meet him in a cabaret or low public house in the neighborhood of the Place Vendôme. The unsuspecting broker was punctual to his appointment. So were the Count de Horn and his two associates, whom he introduced as his particular friends. After a few moments' conversation, the Count de Horn suddenly sprang upon his victim and stabbed him 3 times in the breast with a poignard. The man fell heavily to the ground, and while the Count was employed in rifling his portfolio of bonds in the Mississippi and Indian schemes to the amount of 100,000 crowns, Mille, the Piedmontese, stabbed the unfortunate broker again and again to make sure of his death. But the broker did not fall without a struggle, and his cries brought the people of the cabaret to his assistance. Lestang, the other assassin, who had been set to keep watch at a staircase, sprang from a window and escaped, but Mille and the Count de Horn were seized in the very act. This crime, committed in open day and in so public a place as a cabaret, filled Paris with consternation. The trial of the assassins commenced on the following day, and the evidence being so clear, they were both found guilty and condemned to be broken alive on the wheel. The noble relatives of the Count de Horn absolutely blocked up the antechambers of the regent, praying for mercy on the misguided youth and alleging that he was insane. The regent avoided them as long as possible, being determined that, in a case so atrocious, justice should take its course. But the importunity of these influential suitors was not to be overcome so silently, and they at last forced themselves into the presence of the regent, and prayed him to save their house the shame of a public execution. They hinted that the princes de Horn were allied to the illustrious family of Orléans, and added that the regent himself would be disgraced if a kinsman of his should die by the hands of a common executioner. The regent, to his credit, was proof against all their solicitations, and responded to their last argument in the words of Corneille, "Le crime fait la honte, et non pas l'échafaud." Adding that whatever crime there might be in the punishment, he would very willingly share it with the other relatives. Roughly translated, it is the crime that makes the shame, and not the scaffold. Day after day they renewed their entreaties, but always with the same result. At last they thought that if they could interest the Duc de Saint-Simon in their favor, a man for whom the regent felt sincere esteem, they might succeed in their object. The Duke, a thorough aristocrat, was as shocked as they were that a noble assassin should die by the same death as a plebeian felon, and represented to the regent the impolicy of making enemies of so numerous, wealthy, and powerful a family. He urged, too, that in Germany, where the family of D'Arenberg had large possessions, it was the law that no relative of a person broken on the wheel could succeed to any public office or employ until a whole generation had passed away. For this reason, he thought the punishment of the guilty count might be transmuted into beheading, which was considered all over Europe as much less infamous. The regent was moved by this argument, and was about to consent, when Law, who felt peculiarly interested in the fate of the murdered man, confirmed him in his former resolution to let the law take its course. The relatives of de Horn were now reduced to the last extremity. The Prince de Robe Montmorency, despairing of other methods, found means to penetrate into the dungeon of the criminal, and offering him a cup of poison, implored him to save them from disgrace. The Count de Horn turned away his head and refused to take it. Montmorency pressed him once more, and losing all patience at his continued refusal, turned on his heel and exclaiming, "Die then as thou wilt, mean-spirited wretch! Thou art fit only to perish by the hands of the hangman," left him to his fate. De Horn himself petitioned the regent that he might be beheaded, but Law, who exercised more influence over his mind than any other person, with the exception... One moment while the dogs finish their barking. De Horn himself petitioned the regent that he might be beheaded, but Law, who exercised more influence over his mind than any other person, with the exception of the notorious Abbé Dubois, his tutor, insisted that he could not in justice succumb to the self-interested views of the De Horns. The regent had from the first been of the same opinion, and within 6 days after the commission of their crime, De Horn and Mila were broken on the wheel in the Place de Grève. The other assassin, Lestang, was never apprehended. This prompt and severe justice. This prompt and severe justice was highly pleasing to the populace of Paris. Even Monsieur de Quincampoix, as they called Law, came in for a share of their approbation, for having induced the regent to show no favor to a patrician. But the number of robberies and assassinations did not diminish. No sympathy was shown for rich jobbers when they were plundered. The general laxity of public morals, conspicuous enough before, was rendered still more so by its rapid pervasion of the middle classes, who had hitherto remained comparatively pure between the open vices of the class above and the hidden crimes of the class below them. The pernicious love of gambling diffused itself through society, and bore all public and nearly all private virtue before it. For a time, while confidence lasted, an impetus was given to trade, which could not fail to be beneficial. In Paris especially, the good results were felt. Strangers flocked into the capital from every part, bent not only upon making money, but on spending it. The Duchess of Orléans, mother of the regent, computes the increase of the population during this time, from the great influx of strangers from all parts of the world, at 305,000 souls. The housekeepers were obliged to make up beds in garrets, kitchens, and even stables for the accommodation of lodgers, and the town was so full of carriages and vehicles of every description that they were obliged, in the principal streets, to drive at a foot pace for fear of accidents. The looms of the country worked with unusual activity to supply rich laces, silks, broadcloth, and velvets, which, being paid for in abundant paper, increased in price fourfold. Provisions shared the general advance. Bread, meat, and vegetables were sold at prices greater than had ever before been known, while the wages of labor rose in exactly the same proportion. Well, that would be nice, wouldn't it? The artisan, who formerly gained 15 sous per diem, now gained 60. New houses were built in every direction. An illusory prosperity shone over the land, and so dazzled the eyes of the whole nation that none could see the dark cloud on the horizon, announcing the storm that was too rapidly approaching. Law himself, the magician, whose wand had wrought so surprising a change, shared, of course, in the general prosperity. His wife and daughter were courted by the highest nobility, and their alliance sought by the heirs of ducal and princely houses. He bought 2 splendid estates in different parts of France, and entered into a negotiation with the family of the Duc de Sully for the purchase of the Marquisate of Rosny. His religion being an obstacle to his advancement, the regent promised, if he would publicly conform to the Catholic faith, to make him comptroller general of the finances. Law, who had no more real religion than any other professed gambler, readily agreed, and was confirmed by the Abbé de Tencin in the Cathedral of Melun in the presence of a great crowd of spectators. Footnote. The following squib was circulated on the occasion. Fond de tonzel seraphique, malheureux Abbé de Tencin, depuis que l'or est catholique, tout le royaume est capuchin. By the fault of his seraphic zeal, the unfortunate Abbé de Tencin, as soon as law is Catholic, the whole kingdom is Capuchin. Or, if you think that law is Catholic, then the whole kingdom is Capuchin monks. Anyway. On the following day, he was elected honorary churchwarden of the parish of Saint-Roch, upon which occasion he made it a present of the sum of 500,000 livres. His charities, always magnificent, were not always so ostentatious. He gave away great sums privately, and no tale of real distress ever reached his ears in vain. At this time he was... So, the footnote of the previous page is carried over to the next page. This, somewhat weakly and paraphrastically rendered by Justinian in his translation of the memoirs of Louis XV. Tencin, a curse on thy seraphic zeal, which by persuasion hath contrived the means to make the Scotchman at our altars kneel, since which we are all poor as capuchins. At this time he was by far the most influential person of the state. The Duke of Orléans had so much confidence in his sagacity and the success of his plans that he always consulted him upon every matter of moment. He was by no means unduly elevated by his prosperity, but remained the same simple, affable, sensible man that he had shown himself in adversity. His gallantry, which was always delightful to the fair objects of it, was of a nature so kind, so gentlemanly, and so respectful, that not even a lover could have taken offense at it. If upon any occasion he showed any symptoms of haughtiness, it was to the cringing nobles who lavished their adulation upon him till it became fulsome. He often took pleasure in seeing how long he could make them dance attendance upon him for a single favor. To such of his own countrymen as by chance visited Paris and sought an interview with him, he was, on the contrary, all politeness and attention. When Archibald Campbell, Earl of Islay and afterward Duke of Argyll, called upon him in the Place Vendôme, he had to pass through an antechamber crowded with persons of the first distinction, all anxious to see the great financier and to have their names put down as first on the list of some new subscription. Law himself was quietly sitting in his library, writing a letter to the gardener at his paternal estate of Lauriston about the planting of some cabbages. The Earl stayed for a considerable time, played a game of piquet with his countrymen, and left him charmed with his ease, good sense, and good breeding. Among the nobles who, by means of the public credulity at this time, gained sums sufficient to repair their ruined fortunes, may be mentioned the names of the Dukes de Bourbon, de Guiche, de La Force, de Chaulnes, and d'Antin, the Maréchal d'Estrées, the Princes de Rohan, de Poix, and de Léon. Footnote. The Duke de La Force gained considerable sums, not only by jobbing in the stocks, but in dealing in porcelain, spices, etc. It was debated for a length of time in the Parliament of Paris whether he had not, in his quality of spice merchant, forfeited his rank in the peerage. It was decided in the negative. A caricature of him was made, dressed as a street porter, carrying a large bale of spices on his back, with the inscription, Admirez la Force. A pun meaning something like, behold the strength, as in, which I have to have in order to carry these heavy burdens, I suppose. But, yes, the idea that there was something wrong with a nobleman engaging in trade as though, I mean, you know, the old Roman Republic where the patrician class were not allowed to make their profits from this, that they had to get them by plundering nearby nations, thus assuring the martial success of the state, or that was the idea. Sounds rather miserable to me, all told. The Duke de Bourbon, son of Louis XIV by Madame de Montespan, was peculiarly fortunate in his speculations in Mississippi paper. He rebuilt the royal residence of Chantilly in a style of unwonted magnificence. That's unaccustomed, not undesired. And, being passionately fond of horses, he erected a range of stables which were long renowned throughout Europe, and imported 150 of the finest racers from England to improve the breed in France. He bought a large extent of country in Picardy, and became possessed of nearly all the valuable lands lying between the Oise and the Somme. Which, undoubtedly, of course, 70 years later, were confiscated by the revolutionaries and then used as the backing for paper currency, showing which depreciated rapidly, showing that the wheel only goes round again. When fortunes such as these were gained, it is no wonder that law should have been almost worshipped by the mercurial population. Never was monarch more flattered than he was. All the small poets and literateurs of the day poured floods of adulation upon him. According to them, he was the savior of the country, the tutelary divinity of France. Wit was in all his words, goodness in all his looks, and wisdom in all his actions. So great a crowd followed his carriage whenever he went abroad that the regent sent him a troop of horse as his permanent escort to clear the streets before him. It was remarked at this time that Paris had never before seen so It was remarked at this time that Paris had never before been so full of objects of elegance and luxury. Statues, pictures, and tapestries were imported in great quantities from foreign countries and found a ready market. All those pretty trifles in the way of furniture and ornament, which the French excel in manufacturing, were no longer the exclusive playthings of the aristocracy, but were to be found in abundance in the houses of traders and the middle classes in general. Jewelry of the most costly description was brought to Paris as the most favorable mart. Among the rest, the famous diamond, bought by the regent and called by his name, and which long adorned the crown of France. It was purchased for the sum of 2,000,000 livres, under circumstances which show that the regent was not so great a gainer as some of his subjects by the impetus which trade had received. When the diamond was first offered to him, he refused to pay it. He refused to buy it, although he desired above all things to possess it, alleging as his reason that his duty to the country he governed would not allow him to spend so large a sum of the public money for a mere jewel. This valid and honorable excuse threw all the ladies of the court into alarm, and nothing was heard for some days but expressions of regret that so rare a gem should be allowed to go out of France, no private individual being rich enough to buy it. The regent was continually importuned about it, but all in vain until the Duc de Saint-Simon, who, with all his ability, was something of a twaddler, undertook the weighty business. His entreaties, being seconded by law, the good-natured regent gave his consent, leaving to law's ingenuity to find the means to pay for it. The owner took security for the payment of a sum of 2,000,000 livres within a stated period, receiving in the meantime the interest of 5% upon that amount, and being allowed, besides, all the valuable clippings of the gem. Saint-Simon, in his memoirs, relates with no little complacency his share in this transaction. After describing the diamond to be as large as a greengage, of a form nearly round, perfectly white and without flaw, and weighing more than 500 grains, he concludes with a chuckle by telling the world that he takes great credit to himself for having induced the regent to make so illustrious a purchase. In other words, he was proud that he had induced him to sacrifice his duty and buy a bauble for himself at an extravagant price out of the public money. Thus the system continued to flourish till the commencement of the year 1720. The warnings of the Parliament, the too great a creation of paper money would, sooner or later, bring the country to bankruptcy, were disregarded. The regent, who knew nothing whatever of the philosophy of finance, thought that a system which had produced such good effects could never be carried to excess. If 500 millions of paper had been of such advantage, 500 millions additional would be of still greater advantage. This was the grand error of the regent, and which Law did not attempt to dispel. The extraordinary avidity of the people kept up the delusion, and the higher the price of Indian and Mississippi stock, the more billets de banque were issued to keep pace with it. The edifice thus reared might not unaptly be compared to the gorgeous palace erected by Potemkin, that princely barbarian of Russia, to surprise and please his imperial mistress. Huge blocks of ice were piled one upon another. Ionic pillars of chastest workmanship in ice formed a noble portico, and a dome of the same material shone in the sun, which had just strength enough to gild, but not to melt it. It glittered afar like a palace of crystals and diamonds, but there came one warm breeze from the south, and the stately building dissolved away till none were able even to gather up the fragments. So with Law and his paper system. No sooner did the breath of popular mistrust blow steadily upon it than it fell to ruins and none could raise it up again. The first slight alarm that was occasioned was early in 1720. The Prince de Conti, offended that Law should have denied him fresh shares in India stock at his own price, sent to his bank to demand payment in specie of so enormous a quantity of notes that three wagons were required for its transport. Law complained to the regent, and urged on his attention the mischief that would be done if such an example found many imitators. The regent was but too well aware of it, and sending for the Prince de Conti, ordered him, under penalty of his high displeasure, to refund to the bank 2/3 of the specie which he had withdrawn from it.
Oh dear, what now? Yes? Yes. Right, I'm in Texas, so it's about 10:45. Yes. Yes. Briefly. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. They have islets, I think. Okay, well, clips will work too. What we're working with is panels of fencing, which have horizontal and vertical wires, not the typical diamond chain-link fence. Anyway, they can be clipped onto the horizontal wires of the fence, I'm sure. That should pose no difficulty. You said that... Yes, and you said that you had gotten... You'd tried to contact Tom Veal and hadn't heard back from him. I have no deficit of space at this point. I have 7,000 square feet, of which relatively little is allocated. The main matter is simply, it may require more fencing panels, but those are, I think, can still be ordered until some... So, yes, give me an idea of how many... Basically, the thing is, what the dimensions of the display items are and how many of them are, and I can work out how many linear feet are required for display. Now and then, yes. Mm-hmm. 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 Right. And dark rooms are less common these days than they once were. Dark rooms being less common these days than they once were. Yes. Yes. All right. Right. Yeah, there was some discussion of having a general in memoriam, which is probably wise, but I don't know who would put it together. I was, however, hoping that some folks in Lasphus would be willing to help me put together a couple of in memoriam panels specifically for Marty Cantor and Carl Lemke to display in the fanzine lounge, since I have to say that they deserve recognition as fanziners. Yes. Well, I had the impression that just because of his efforts as in the club, that he was also sort of by default a major contributor as far as the club publications that Well, even so, if there's going to be a general in memoriam exhibit, then I would expect that Lemke would be in it for his contributions to fandom, and that somebody in Lasphus would be the best to assemble it. Well, even if he's not coming, I might be able to get him to send me something. Well, let's see. What is the best way? Yes, I've spoken to him a few times, actually. Run into him at conventions and so on. Let's see. Other contact information you may have for him might... if you would, please. So 015. Sapling Lane. Okay. Okay. All six. He's all at sixes and sevens. Yes. There's little to be lost by trying it. All right. I certainly will. All right. Good day, then. Bye. Sorry about that. I'm involved with the upcoming North American Science Fiction Convention, and that was one of the folks who's helping me organize the exhibits. Hey.